This is Carol Pearson, December 12, 2014, entitled Becoming a Transforming Leader. This was recorded on DVD, and there are some images, and those are available on the in the library at the Seattle Jung Society.
Hi, everybody. I'm Kelly. Welcome. Thank you for coming tonight. I'm going to introduce our guest tonight, Carol Pearson, a world-renowned expert on depth, psychology, and transformational leadership. Carol's latest book, The Transforming Leader, New Approaches to Leadership for the 21st Century,
and her work were honored last month at the International Leadership Association conference that was held in San Diego. And they gave her the award for the book's original and important contribution to the field, while also evidencing excellence in scholarship, coupled with relevance to contemporary leadership practice in a global context. So join me, please, in welcoming Dr. Carol Pearson.
Well, I've had the privilege of being here. Is this on yet, by the way? Okay. But tonight, I want to start with just saying I got here a little early and watched the extraordinary leadership of the team for the Jung Society as people apparently effortlessly, where everybody was doing what they needed to do to get this show on the road, being cheerful, being nice to one another, being welcoming to me and everybody who walked in the room. And I thought, how nice to watch leadership being done the way it ought to be as I move to talk with you about the transforming leader. So I want to check out your leadership potential here. How many of you do nothing to improve the world, but you sit and grouse a lot? Okay. How many of you help? What? It's the national pastime. It's you know, it's up there with football. Yeah, baseball. Okay. How many of you are active in the Jung Society? How many of you are leaders in your family? How many of you are leaders in your church or synagogue or mosque or a New Age spiritual movement? Okay. How many of you take leadership where you work? And by that doesn't mean you have to have a leadership position. Okay. So we're starting with a definition of the transforming leader. The transforming leader is somebody in whatever roles they are in who is tracking what's going on and what's needed and takes the action that they can take to make a difference. And I would guess that most of you do that most of the time. I always like to save a little time to sit on the couch and grouse because that's, as I said, the national pastime. So I'm going to... In the introduction, there was a reference to where this idea came from of the book, The Transforming Leader, came from. But I want to say a little bit more about that. It started with Judy Sorum Brown and I taking a walk in our neighborhood. We were colleagues at the University of Maryland. We were both teaching in the executive program for the public policy school, and we had students, most of whom were fairly mid to high level in either government or a lot in the military, some in private company contractors. And they were saying that most of what they'd been taught about leadership just wasn't working. And most of them said they were being evaluated based on an old standard of old model of leadership, which is the kind of command and control. I'm in charge. I know everything that ought to be done. I will set a vision. You will do it. With the assumption that a good leader would understand the whole big picture and be able to convince anybody to do what they wanted them to do. And it made no sense. So Judy and I thought, why don't we look at what is working? What is working in the world right now? And it just so happened that the Fetzer Institute had invited us into a think tank, to participate in a think tank, and we mentioned this idea, and over a period of 3 years, we called together leaders who had made a transforming difference, and also the scholars who study them, and the educators who teach about them, or teach about leadership, and that had studied some of the transformational change. And we had them in circle in dialogue, in our task for usually 3 days at a time, so we really could help them go deeper in the dialogues that they had with one another. And our job was just primarily to create safety so that they would be honest with one another and not posture and talk about how great they are. And what we found is that we didn't need to do that. They were so eager to just talk to other people who wanted to figure out what's working today, what's working in our world today. And out of that came this book. So I feel very honored to have been part of this process and to have been in circle with people of immense talent and immense heart. At the time I did that, I was director of the James McGregor Burns Academy of Leadership, and it was Jim Burns, whose picture is here, who coined the term the transforming leader. It has come down in the literature as a transformational leader, but that's not exactly what he meant. The transforming leader is one who transformed the outside by first transforming the inside. And that the process of a transforming leader is that by the leader becoming transformed, the leader helps the team or the people that work with, or the movement, people to be transformed, or as he used to tell me, to get people to let their better angels come out. And by doing that, then that the structures and policies could change to be transformed as well. He just died last month, and so I want to honor him for being one of those people who not only wrote things that transformed the field, but also is a really fine human being. One of those people that you like to stand next to because it just feels nice. Their energy feels nice. I also want to, here we are in a young society, is to call your attention to the fact that much of what people said in circle reinforces many Jungian concepts. And so throughout this talk, I'll be referencing some of those as well. You can see them on the screen. But most importantly, you know, the whole importance of the individuation process, and most importantly, synchronicity, and what the idea that there are meaningful coincidences means for our sense of reality and how things happen. Tomorrow, I'm going to be focusing primarily on archetypes and in you, if you come, and in the organizations of which you're a part. And the whole idea is that there's an interface between we're always affecting the world and the world is always affecting us. So if we can start understanding the archetypal presence and archetypal presences in us, but also archetypal presences in the places where we spend most of our time, we can understand that we're in a movie together and that there's a plot going on that we may not even understand what that plot is unless we start to see that complex interaction. The structure of this talk actually goes along with the structure of the book, The Transforming Leader, except the order is a little different. I'm going to start out with just some of the challenges of the 21st century for leadership at all levels, which are things you know, but it's always good to get them on the table when we begin to talk about what leadership ought to be. And then there are three major themes about leadership, transforming leadership today. One is the importance of leaders doing their inner work. Jungian psychology is often part of that inner work. The second is updating our thinking so that we're thinking in a 21st century way. And the last one is what that means for the way that we lead. I remember some years ago where there was a lot of real excitement about the potential for global interdependence, which we should still hold, because the idea was that now that we're connected, particularly with the internet and social media and other kinds of ways that we can be in touch with people all over the world, we would come to understand one another, we would communicate with one another, and perhaps we could have world peace, less conflict, more cooperation. Maybe we could have social justice because we would understand other people better than we did before. Now, all of this is happening, but it's not the only thing that is happening. I'm right. Okay, that's for the analysts. the shadow change. There's always a shadow. When I was at Pacifica, I used to love working with Lionel Corbett, who some of you probably know. And he would, and we were doing stuff. We had a lot of fun there. We did archetypes of Pacifica. We did type of Pacifica. We did dreams, people's dreams about Pacifica. And Lionel would always say, "Yes, but what's the shadow?" Well, there is a shadow of everything, and global interdependence has come to be, our awareness is huge about that. You can just think about climate change, for example. It's not like our national boundaries mean much if there's acid rain. And if there's a hole in the ozone layer, that while we're making decisions primarily in individual countries, the impact is being felt by everybody. There's also a way in which global independence means that if you're in business, for example, that a lot of global businesses, their parts are being made in one part of the world, they're being put together in another part of the world, they're being marketed somewhere else. If something happens, say a coup, a natural disaster, any kind of political upheaval, businesses all over the world are compromised. And that can happen. That can happen in so many other ways. Whole businesses go out of business because something has happened in some other part of the world. At the time I was starting to think about this, I was in a public policy school. And so one of the things that we talked a lot about was how it was that George Bush, who came to be president, now remember, George Bush had, even though he came from a wealthy family, didn't much travel outside the U.S. And what did he get hit with? 9/11. Surprise out of left field, total surprise out of left field, and not one that his background prepared him for. And then President Obama, I mean, here he is with a background in community organizing and all kinds of good cause things, perfectly well prepared to do something about poverty, and what did he get hit with is an international recession. His expertise is not economics. And you may notice that at many times in one's life, something happens that's out of left field. Now, sometimes this can be global interdependence, what we don't see coming because it is also complex. But it could also just be life, like somebody dies. we get a bad diagnosis. Somebody who we trusted betrays us. There's a way in which in life and in life that very often when things are going the best or we think everything is great, something hits us out of left field. And in the international arena, there's just one more element in which where that happens to people. The second major change is the increased pace of change. And there's a promise of change. Again, in the information age, the whole idea that people have shared access to knowledge through virtual means. People now, by the way, one of the problems in California's higher education is that many students are deciding they don't need to go to college because they can find it all out and form study groups and go off to Edison and get a degree. But nevertheless, it's a wonderful thing that any of us can find out. I mean, I'm writing a new book right now, and I think of something I can't remember. It's amazing. I mean, I know you all do this, but just to Google it, and there it is. Wow. It's an amazing time that we're in. But we're all also dealing with information overload. We can't keep up. There's so much, and there's so much is available, and now the difficulty is how in the world are we ever interpret all that information and make sense of it and know what's important, what's not important, and even what's factual and trustworthy. So here we are. We have a lot of problems in the larger world, a lot of them listed here. If you can think about even just the example of the movement between being in a world like in World War II and then the Cold War, where we had what we considered good guys and bad guys, and we knew who the enemy was, to random terrorist groups. And there's a sense of in every part of life, an increasing amount of randomness rather than traditional orders. Order continuing. I wanted to actually read the quote from Robert Kennedy. Few will have the greatness to bend history itself, but each of us can work to change a small portion of events. And in the total of all those acts will be written the history of this generation. This is a time that so many people are saying in different ways that what's going to happen in the world depends as much on you and me as on the great leaders of the world. That if we step up to the plate, and more about that later in this talk. Martha Beck talked about all these changes as being like a tsunami, kind of overwhelming tsunami coming at us. But this is a picture that she uses. And do you see that little speck up there? That is a surfer who evidently lived to tell the tale. Now, I would not recommend doing that if there's a tsunami that comes our way. I'm not going to be out there surfing. Maybe you will. I don't recommend it as a way to do it. But the point that she was making is that if we think of just what's happening in our lives as a kind of ongoing tsunami, we need to learn to have the attitude of a surfer to be able to ride with it. And Kathy Allen, in an article in The Transforming Leader, talks about chaos theory and biomimicry, which is amazing, learning to do, as leaders, to do things in the natural way, paying attention to the way the natural world does it, which is not to fight itself most of the time. She gives a similar kind of metaphor of seeing a mother and a daughter walking down a slippery ramp, which has just actually been waxed. And the mother has on heels and a very nice suit and is clutching the handrail and going down very carefully. And the daughter says, "We." Which is the idea that in some way, living in the modern world, which is so unpredictable and fast, that the more we can have that kind of attitude and flow with what is happening, Well, we try to be a force for good, of course, as well, the better it will be. With that in mind, the question is, how do we get there? How do we gain some kind of ease in the world in which we're now living? Part of that, then, is the Jungian work of individuation. And because we can't have that, if you haven't done your in the work to find out who you are and to go down into do your shadow work, be able to see and be aware of the sometimes we cause our own problems, and a lot of people are busy blaming other people, so they don't have to look at that. That happens to nations as well as individuals. And part of the individuation process is to say, yeah, part of that is in me. And to move in a way, to move past the monsters in the unconscious, down to connect with the treasure, which is our mission, our purpose, who we really are, what we're here to do, what's our calling, and to find that. What I found with the leaders that we were interviewing in the dialogue process of really listening to is that they knew who they were. And they weren't the kind of people who just wants to be the star of the show. They were there because they had a sense of that they had a life call. And very often it was to do something that was in the service of the world. And out of that, what it does is it creates a non-arrogant way to be a leader. It's not like, oh, I'm cool, I'm the leader. It's the leader is there to create something new in the world, and extremely humbly, but not, you see some people, we talk about facilitative leadership, which is only about facilitating everybody getting there, saying what they want, or giving their ideas, and the leader doesn't do anything but kind of pull this together. That the individuation process is also about claiming where you stand. Whatever your leadership is, and your leadership could be a leadership just in a moment. You're in a group. I heard the other a friend who was doing a workshop on diversity had a woman come up, and she said, I don't know if this is a diversity issue, but she said, I was at a block party, and I realized it was the only Democrat. And I didn't say anything. And then she said, but the next party I came out and admitted. Well, there are moments, this doesn't sound like, a terribly scary thing to do, but there are moments that we go through any week. And the fact that if we don't agree with what's happening, we don't have to fight with people, but we don't just shut up. We show up. And part of the individuation process is also know what you stand for and stand there. And in leadership of actually being able to be firmly grounded in who you are and what you're about, even while you're open to the impact, the insights of others. In the book, too, we also talk about the archetypal dimension and the importance of connecting with the archetypes, or archetypes being fundamental patterns in the psyche or in nature that persist in all times and places. Matthew Fox has written about leadership and spirituality, but also for this book he wrote about it in leadership and the via positiva, the path of, these are process archetypes, the path of being positive, seeing what's good in the world, treasuring it, having a positive vision, but also via negativa, which is partly don't be in denial, admit when something's going on, face it head on, but also have the ability to let go and to empty out via creativa, which is all about being in a constant flow of creating your life and creating the world that you want to see, and via transformativa, which is about particularly social justice and environmental justice, moving, taking action to make the world the way you know it ought to be. Tomorrow I'll be working with person archetypes, that personages, heroes, sages, caregivers, that show up in individuals and in organizations and how we can tap into that wisdom as well. And there's new literature now that is connecting, that is showing us that there are literally neurons in the heart that are like brain neurons, and that the idea that comes up in almost every spiritual tradition that we should make our decisions with our heart, not our head, has now grounding in science. That opening the heart is actually a physical thing. It's not just a metaphor. And that if we can open our hearts and use those neurons in a better way, we can do what we can act more in the service of what we care most about. The inner work is also particularly around one archetype I think stands out. For leadership, the old archetype used to be ruler, kind of on, you know, like the king or queen, in charge of everything. But now it's more like the magician, and who is connected with everything and connected with his or herself. And you can think of Yoda in Star Wars with trust the Force, Luke. That is a sense of being trusting some kind of energy that comes through you when you are most completely on the path that is right for you and that is yours. I bet everybody in this room has had those experiences where even if the situation is unpleasant, you feel like this is the right place for me right this minute, and there's some energy that's there for you to do what needs to be done. And you probably also had the experience of feeling however lovely the setting is and the situation, a little empty. And because this piece does not fit for me. I don't know if you saw the movie Avatar. I just re-saw it. It's a little bit cheesy, but there is that moment where the great hero, who is the Marine who's been wounded in battle and cannot walk, goes to the planet where the people are connected with, they're totally connected with one another and with the earth, and they have a earth mother who's a tree, and they have these really cool braids. Do you remember this? Did you see it? And yeah, they can connect up through their braids. Well, and he, I think it's so cool. I want a braid like that. But at the end, he joins them and leaves behind the people, like sort of like us, only worse than the movie. And there's something in many of the images that are coming to us through the media, not through the news media, news channels, but through art, that are telling us about a different way to do heroism that is... that combines the hero strength with connecting up with everything around you. And the last one I'll just mention in terms of inner work is a huge movement that some of you may know in the leadership field on presencing. Peter Senge and a number of other of his colleagues wrote the groundbreaking book on this, which is really about they're telling the stories of how it is they got transformed and changed their view, and so that they were more connected with other people, trying to do dialogue groups where people would feel very, very connected to one another and speak out of their deeper souls, and through that beginning to feel very connected with the planet and the earth. And from that, they say now that in this modern world, leadership is as much about who you are as what you do, and the quality of your consciousness as any kind of skill. So, second category is thinking like a 21st century person. Many of you would know something about complexity and chaos theories, which basically look at the fact that everything seems to be connected and apparently random, but not really. And the immense complexity with global interdependence, if we understand that, then we realize it's more complex than we're ever going to understand. There are too many factors all the time. It's like weather, which is like that as well. And in that context, there is meaning. And that's where the Jungian idea of synchronicity comes in, that there are meaningful coincidences that can't be explained causally at all. But in this immense array of factors going here, there, and yonder, the idea is what they are now calling the butterfly effect, which is comes out of weather prediction, where they say a butterfly's wings flapping in Tokyo can affect the weather in New York, that everything affects everything, and that the logic that comes out of this is the logic that you're as powerful as the president or anybody else, that you are as much a center of this chaotic flow as anybody is, and there's no way to know what you do, how what you do is influencing the world. You don't see it, but you don't know. You may have smiled at somebody who was depressed, and they didn't kill themselves. And they went on to do something really amazing. I mean, there's no way to fully understand the impact that we have as we go through our days. There's also just a sense that leaders need to become skilled in pattern recognition. Meg Wheatley is one of my favorite experts on looking at chaos theory and what it means for leadership. She has a wonderful book called Leadership in the New Sciences, in which she talks about within randomness, there are patterns, and they call those patterns fractals. And they're not caused by anything we can find, they just occur. And she sees those as the archetypes of the natural world, where that something comes up that is just like preformed. Other people in other fields, this idea of looking at patterns is coming up everywhere, are looking at social networks and the idea that leaders need to understand the complex ways that people are involved with each other. Some people are sleeping with each other. Some people are having expert conversations. Some people are seen as the one to go to for some kind of information. And that to get an idea out there, it's best, rather than just having a marketing campaign, is to understand those complex relationships and who you can influence, who will have the biggest influence on others. And then, of course, the changes in our environment have caused scientists to begin to really understand ecosystems and to understand, rather than thinking about survival of the fittest and competition, to think about how to help have healthy ecosystems, which is then entering all the other fields in the social sciences that are thinking much more in terms, for example, in terms of just looking at somebody in psychotherapy. Are there issues their issues? Are they system issues in their family or their organizations? And sometimes we just have to take a bigger look. Meg Wheatley is very big in the whole idea of self-organization and that how much happens that people in the workplace, at home, in families, self-organize. They don't wait to have a job description and have somebody to tell them what to do. They just see a need and get going. And my favorite quote from her is, how would you take 10 tons of water, it's not a quote, it's a paraphrase, how would you take 10 tons of water and suspend it in the air? You'd build a cloud. And what that ends up meaning it seems to me, is enormously profound for now when so many of our problems seem insolvable. But there are also so many people who are like the little drops of water who are organizing themselves and making a contribution. Let's hope that that cloud works. So what does this mean in terms of leading? I love kids' movies, by the way. I don't know if anybody here has ever seen the movie The Incredibles. But it seemed like many children's books and movies are really parables about what's going on in the world. And if you remember the father in the story, he's the one bent over this working in an insurance company. And he is a hero. He's definitely a strong, powerful hero like Superman or something like that in a world that doesn't want heroes. And so he has tried to be normal, and he's sitting there with this big hulking body at this little bitty desk where they don't want to give people the money that they deserve for whatever their situation is. And he's getting more and more depressed. And you know, it seems to me that in our society, where so much of the thinking is extremely hierarchical and status-oriented. Arianna Huffington just wrote a book in which she said most people are just think they're going to get happiness through money and power. And she adds a third dimension, which is well-being. But what my first response is, who is she hanging around with? But my second response is, there's so much pressure to be better than, to have more money, to have more status in various kinds of ways, to be the best. And what that actually means is that we begin to clone to a way of being that we learn through magazines and the media in various ways that we're supposed to be. But what that means, that also means, is whatever our real superpower is, can very often be repressed in the in our desire to look really good. What I would notice, of course, you know, the world is in peril in this movie, and so of course he comes back to his full superpower. But he also does it in a team, which is the more modern way. It isn't the lone hero. I think it's hysterical that the superpower of his wife is that she can stretch to meet whatever needs, as women are prone to do, and as kids have superpowers too. Okay. Another children's story that I particularly love is the story Jerome the Frog. Jerome knew in his heart that he was a hero, but he was just a little frog, and he goes into this little town, and he tells them that he's a hero, and they laugh at him, and they say, well, if you are so heroic, would you just go kill the dragon that's been burning our town and terrorizing us? So Jerome goes over, and he's just this little frog with his little bitty knife and sword, and he goes up to this huge dragon, and the dragon, of course, just shoots fire at him and is terrifying, and but Jerome sort of stands around until the dragon gets tired of terrorizing him, and Jerome convinces him. He talks to him, and he says, you know, talks to him about how much he's hurting people by doing these things. And the dragon says, "But it's my nature to do this." And so Jerome convinces him to burn the town garbage on Tuesdays and Thursdays. Well, I think that's a key leadership skill, is to find out who somebody really is and find something good they can do. Okay. The new form, too, is not sitting actually the way we were sitting, but sitting in a circle. And that's not just a sweet little thing, because the task right now, since nobody, you know, we can't even, most of us, we see an automobile accident, you got five people and you have five stories about what happened. And, you know, we can fight about who's right, but in truth, it's because we're seeing it from different perspectives and different lenses. And through the stories that are already in our heads and the prejudices that we have. So that to get a full picture of anything, we need to harvest the wisdom of the group. And that there's a process that needs to happen for that to happen. It's not just having people sit in a circle. It's creating a situation where everyone feels connected to that enterprise and to one another and safe. And I think there's an energetic connection that happens between people, so that if you were to be able to see people's energy fields, they're connected all the way around. And in that context, you can move to a deeper level of truth while you're also getting a more complete truth. In action, this sometimes reflects itself as groups or teams working together, a little bit like jazz improv. Groups where different people have the solo at different times or take the lead at different times, but everybody is listening so that what comes out is a really beautiful kind of music. I used to experience that making Thanksgiving dinner with my mom and my aunts in the kitchen, and I see work teams that have that as well, that easy connected flow of being very aware of what everybody else is doing and not getting in their way as you do your part. Jeremy Taylor does this amazing work in community development, or used to. Now he writes about it and does other things, but in communities where people had very little trust, and sometimes there were big racial divides that were going on. And what he would do is he'd use dream groups to get people who are fighting with each other to talk about their dreams. One of the things they found out is their dreams weren't that different. They had similar kind of, you know, imagery and similar kind of concerns. But also, it helped them to realize, to understand projection, that we're always projecting. And we're projecting, our dreams can be a projection from our unconscious of what the unconscious is seeing. And our conscious mind is projecting, like this projector, onto the world. And the more that we can understand that, the more we can stop fighting with one another and be able to learn from one another, because if we don't, we won't be able to have what we say we want. This is the holiday season we're going to, you know, peace on earth, goodwill to men and women. We're not going to get that unless we learn to withdraw our projections onto one another. And then my amazing article by Zachary Green. Now, Zachary is this, he's a professor at the University of San Diego, and he wrote about actually finding the third thing, but I changed it to the third story because that's the way my mind works. And he uses this with people individually and with groups. And the individual part, he says that it started out for him trying to figure out about being an African-American and an American, and how to get that together, find a third story in which he was both, that made sense to him, and not feeling pulled in two different directions. And then on top of that, he said he's a fundamentalist Christian and gay, which created another internal tension to find out what would be the third story. He never told me what that third story was, but what would be that third story that allowed him to understand the wholeness of his character? And then he works with groups, and he talks about the process of most of our conflicts are that I have a view of reality. I have my story. You have your story. And we're fighting about which version of the story is correct. And he said if we can find that overarching story, that third story, that we're in together, that we can move out of conflict into knowing what it is that we could do. By the way, I'm hoping for that with our Democrats and Republicans right now. I'd like to have our government work. I may throw it back on some of you who are taking the workshop tomorrow, late in the towards the end of the workshop, and see what we come up with. And one example that he gives about that has touched me deeply is in the conflict between the Israelis and the Palestinians. There's a group that call themselves the Women in Black that meet together regularly, and they're all women who lost somebody to that war. And what they are aware of is the third story is the loss of life. It's not this, it's not a power dynamic. It is not who's wrong. It's about we have to stop. And they grieve. And they think about what they will do. That's an extremely powerful way to do that. We have now conflict in our country around the police action with African-American young men. And one of our challenges is, what is the third story? And how, as a nation, with a history of racial injustice, and who love and honor our police, how can we create a world where that tension could dissipate? Otto Scharmer has created something. He's working with people, all countries around the world, in a process he calls Theory U, which is very like psychotherapy, only groups. He takes sometimes very large groups, small groups, through a pattern of going of the descent and the ascent. And the descent is about understanding what has been and the story we've made about what has been, to go into a deeper, more soul place together and come out with new images and new plans. So it's probably on the forefront of Jungian activity is to do for groups what has been done for individuals and is still so powerful. So basically some of this too is moving beyond Jung's actual formulations. If some of you would remember that Jung warned against the participation mystique and the pressure that most of us feel to, when we enter a group, to belong and therefore to show the part of us only that is like that group. And of course, we all do that to some degree. But because of individuation work and other ways, other strategies for people to get much more solidly in themselves and know who they are, we're now in a situation where the challenge that we are being faced with is to be able to, as individuals in a leadership stance, to be as firmly, as strong as the old-fashioned command and control leader, while still being very connected to other people, very curious about what they have to say, very connected with the earth and with the call of the future, not just the past, but what is the future calling from me? And the more that we can balance that sense of being fully connected in a sense of belonging with the human community and being ourselves is the capacity to which I think we will be able to address the problems that face us. So, you're the answer. You. We all are. The future is in our own and our collective hands. We create ripple effects by who we are, what we think, and what we do every day. So,
Thank you.
Is this on? Are we good?
No.
Oh, yeah.
You're not on.
Thank you. Brian's the dude. All right. I want to just take 1 minute to talk about tomorrow, because I'd love to have a lot of you come. And it's going to be experiential. There will be times that I will be presenting, and then there will be experiential parts. The focus of tomorrow is to look at, first, archetypes in you, what archetypes are strong in you. If you've happened to take the PMAI online, that's cool, but you don't need to have to come to the workshop. The Pearson Moore Archetype Indicator was mentioned in the ad for today, and it's online, and the program tells you how to get there, I believe so. But you don't have to do it. Don't feel like you have to do that to come or that it'll be necessary. It's just additional background. And then we'll be moving into archetypes of either your workplace or an organization you're a part, but to really look at what I was mentioning about the interface between who you are and this larger archetypal set of stories that you're a part of, and what that might say to you. Just a quick example. I was once doing some work with an insurance company, and there was a woman who told me she hated herself for working there and she hated the place. And turned out that the place, the dominant archetype, was the ruler. It was very bureaucratic, hierarchical, traditional place. And she, her dominant archetypal energy was creator. And as we worked on that a little bit, what we realized is, why was she there? She was there because she didn't have any ruler archetype in her. And she needed to take charge of her life. She needed to be more organized. She needed to be more disciplined. And they desperately needed her, because what they needed is what she had. So that she still worked there, and it was still uncomfortable sometimes, but she didn't hate it anymore, and she didn't hate herself for being there, because she knew why she was there. She was there to give what she had and to receive what they had. Now, that's just a very simple, a lot of times it's more complex than that, what that third story is. But that's the kind of thing that can happen. Towards the end, we might talk a little bit about, depending on how much we time, that's my major emphasis, so I want to be sure we do that. If we have a little extra time before 4 o'clock, then I'm going to give you the task of figuring out the archetypes of the Democrats and Republicans and Independents. And if there's any link that might be, you know, cultural healing, where cultural healing could happen, and you do not have to, you do not have to represent any group. You're just looking at looking at those groups. And if you complain and don't want to do that, we'll do something else. But that's what's happening tomorrow, and I do hope I see many of you. So this is a time. One person who came to talk with me, I asked if he would just say a few words about what he was telling me to the group. And as an example, that you could be asking questions to me or the whole group, but you could also just be sharing your insights around the theme of transforming leadership, because I know there's a good bit of wisdom in this room.
Okay, during intermission, I said to Carol, congratulations, you are Jungian of the 21st century, and I really appreciate that. And then I told her about my work in Congo, which some of you may know about from a Jung Society lecture here, where I'm working with traumatized communities, collective trauma. And what Carol was talking about today very much resonates with me. The way this new leadership style evolved in me was being in an environment that was so harsh, that was in many ways, or is in many ways, so terrible in terms of lack of humanity, the kind of new form of warfare, using terrorism and sexual atrocities, etc. So in that environment, what do I do? And what I experienced is that all kinds of strengths developed in me, out of which came relating to the local communities, and together we were able to come up with steps towards addressing some of these very difficult issues they are facing. And so it doesn't happen in isolation. It really happens in, it happened to me in community. And it's a big difference to what is happening with so many NGOs who go into these difficult environments with an attitude, I know what's good for you. That just doesn't work. And I use the coin of listening with the heart. And the heart is a place where the Africans locate their emotions. And I appreciated your comment on listening with the heart. And I think that's also happening in the consulting room. But it translates into the larger world. And we can transfer some of these ideas and apply them in communities.
Okay, my ruler archetype. Here are the rules. The rules are you can talk to the mic, you can ask a question, you can share something you know. You could say, I don't need the mic, I can stand up and project. I can sit, I could lie down and project. okay, so who's next?
I can try to lie down and project. Right. Oh, seriously. Let's see.
Points too short.
We can pick for that.
I've been coming for 35 years, and this is really exciting to hear someone that connects it to another one of the worlds that I live in. Mm. And how would I say it? I guess what's so helpful, I guess I want to make a report about tonight, is I walked out of an organization that I've been involved in for 44 years last night, saying I just wasn't going to keep contributing without more happening. And I wrote a letter to one of the people about it last night, and a woman leader who works at Boeing responded so sensitively today that I got so much about the abuse I've been taking this organization. And what was so helpful about tonight is to realize that this organization isn't transforming in a way that is enough for me, and I've given years of my attempt to seed and cultivate the organization, and that I really need to find some other place. But I was so touched by this woman that it actually called me to look at other ways I can engage in the organization in terms of my own issues that were revealed and I got access to out of, and what came to a head in terms of, I had a Feldenkrais private session last week where when a woman put her arm over, I was back at when I left the hospital 73 years and 1 month ago and being swaddled in a blanket, and that I was also walking out last night like I did at 18 months, and I was running away from what my father said in the letter was that I think we're doing something he didn't like. And so I was both acting that out, but I was also creating out to living into the unknown of I don't know where this is going to take me. And I'm both going to attempt to reconfigure in the past and to keep going. And you're what you've been articulating, because this has been the field I've been working in organizations, I go in and warehouse at Starbucks, and I think, I wasn't sure, because I'd heard all of her, I was familiar with all this, but when I actually looked in the book there, there's some amazing stuff in the book, and I'm quite excited. I'm so glad you're here.
Thank you. You and then you.
This is sort of just a, I'm just curious if you have any commentary on a question of something I see coming up in nonprofit type organizations. There's often this huge desire to collaborate and be respectful, but there's kind of a dilemma in that I see pragmatically a lot of times that actually results in not making decisions and kind of practically not getting stuff done. Mm-hmm. And I'm just curious if you have any perspectives on that.
Yeah, I could start, and then maybe some other people will want to add as the conversation goes on. Yeah, the having everybody in circle is good for analyzing a situation and figuring out what could be done and getting to a new level. It's not very good at getting things done. And so, you know, if I was working with a team, that would be, when we're doing that, we'd sit like that. When it's really better to sit around a table, when you're trying to figure out, okay, now who's going to do what? We're a team. We got to get this done. And some people say it's also good to have some, sit in a U at some point with, you know, whiteboards and stuff up there to say, okay, what are we not thinking about and whose view is not in this room? But I think people get enamored, you know, this, I was giving high points here, get enamored with the idea of dialogue, not recognizing that it's not good for every stage of the process. And even when I'm talking about jazz improv, you don't get there immediately. I mean, you usually start with a lot of people learning their role and learning how to trust the other person. I mean, it's kind of a goal. And that very much more traditional management strategies often can be used to get people to work as a team in a more here's the play kind of way until that kicks in. Does that help? Yeah.
I'm guessing that the Hero Within about 25 years ago, originally something on order. And I remember reading it the first time and resonated, loved the book. And then I went back 5, 6, 7 years later, read it again. And I thought, oh, I got that idea from this book. And that things that had become part of my way of being in the world, part of my way of thinking. And when I reread it that second time, I've always hoped I would meet you so I could share this with you. That what I, in the introduction, the very end of the preface of the introduction or something, you wrote, and I think this is pretty close, if you should happen to run into me 20 years from now, don't ask me to defend the ideas in this book. Ask me what I've learned since then. And that made such an impact on me, and I see it in the way, you know, you've gone on and explored, taken your work to other areas like the leadership stuff, but just the fact that something that had resonated, I almost wanted you to say, no, let's lock these ideas in concrete because they're so good for me, but that example, that last sentence in preface of the introduction always stuck with me, and I just wanted to thank you for that.
Well, thank you. I'm really touched. Of course, I also put it in there because my memory isn't that good.
But your sense of humor is. So.
I might say, did I say that? All right, who else? Anybody want to add anything about the question that was about process taking too much time when there's work to be done? Is there somebody else who'd like to add? Yeah.
What has been working for us is definitely following strict rules. Whoever manages the agenda items of the process is just watching the time, and everybody on the circle on the table has his chance to tell his opinion once. So we are all heard. We have 12 more board members, and 9 advisory members and 11 artistic directors. So our meetings can run forever. So strict rules for how archetypes works for us. Maybe it's old management style, but it works in this setting. So that's what I mean.
Yeah. Yeah, thank you. That's the other thing. All leadership is contextual. You know, I mean, if, you know, I'm a soldier and if guns are firing at me, I don't think I want to sit down and find out what everybody thinks. Okay. Who else? Yes.
I just realized when you were talking, I kind of just had this, I don't know, awareness. I just hate leaders. Leadership, I was just getting, my stomach was turning and my blood pressure was starting to go up. I'm starting to sweat and I thought I was going to have to leave. And I thought, where's this coming from? I shouldn't have come. But the thing I realized is, as I was like digging back in my head, is like, I grew up in the mid-60s, you know, and I just felt like as a kid, I just got impressed with these just really bad images of leadership, you know, like Nixon, and then you have a couple of good guys and they shoot him down, you know, like Kennedy and Martin Luther King. I mean, all that stuff. I was watching TV all the time as a kid, you know, and I think it's, I just grew up with those images, you know. If you're really good, you know, someone's probably going to take you down, or you're going to become a target, or if you're, you know, you're really bad, you're going to stay in power for a while, you know, or sometimes I wonder if leaders get into a position and then they went into the position with certain intentions, but then the weight of maybe the projections of the masses and the pressures that they're under once they get in that position really starts to move them in, or creates a field in which they're starting to act very differently. You know, they succumb to the weights, these invisible forces of whatever when they step into that role. And every, you know, I don't know, I guess I have a really, you know, tarnished image of leadership, you know, based on kind of my own experiences. I don't know, I think it's basically the collective influence thing. You know, everybody was so hopeful a lot of times when Barack Obama came, you know, got elected, but things just don't seem to go well. I don't know, that's just my personal perspective. I would never want to be a leader myself. That's why I stay in the back of the room at lectures.
All right.
But I felt like I had to say something because nobody was saying this kind of
thing. Okay, first of all, let me say that was really profound. First of all, and I feel I need to say something about it, and probably it's from my own, out of my own experience. As people, there's an archetypal process that happens, that we select leaders and we want saviors. And we don't want to do the work ourselves. And what typically happens is that for a lot of our leaders, yes, I'm still mourning some of the leaders that you're talking about that were martyred, is that some people, and sometimes all people, in that case some people, but when somebody looks like they might be a savior, then they kill him. I mean, it's Jesus on the cross, okay? It's an archetypal pattern. And the only way out of the archetypal pattern is for all of us to carry our part and stop wanting saviors. And recognizing that it's a trap to try to be a savior in that big inflated way. Now, I don't mean that it was that, you know, Martin Luther King shouldn't have done what he did. No, because I think sometimes you're really called, you're fully called to a role that might even include martyrdom. And it's your calling. But for most of us, we have smaller callings. And if we just did our part, instead of having these huge hopes on our leaders. Obama knew this when he was campaigning. He kept saying, I can't do this for you. We were all in this together. He kept saying it over and over, but he didn't. When he got there, he didn't know how to make that real. And nobody wanted him to. The press didn't want him to. The Congress didn't want him to. The American people went, yeah, he's in front, you know, and then started picking on him. You know, and I think understanding that that's an archetypal process and it isn't pretty. Not all archetypal processes are pretty. And that in that sense, if that's what it means, almost every administrative job I've ever had, I come in and somebody will say, you know, or some group will say, save us. Oh, we're so glad you're here. You can save us. And my typical response is, I'm already feeling, you know, the nails in my hands when you say that. So there were some other comments. Yes?
Well, will you just go to the second part of that? And you said carry our part. And we were having a conversation about trying to make change in our family. And I can't even make changes in the family, let alone out in society. And it's, you know, the way I see it is their story is entrenched. They don't want to hear my story. The population here that's in this classroom is a select population. We're all seekers. Our minds are kind of open to begin with. My family has a closed mind, which I think a lot of society does. And so when our open minds hit these closed minds, there isn't the change that you're saying, the ripple effect. And so I think you're saying, carry and do our part. So what is that part?
Well, I can give an example of a whole bunch of people in the United States. How about gays and lesbians, closeted, big time closeted, in families that didn't want change and they didn't want to know? And their part was to come out. Their part was just to be who they were and come out and be clear about it. And what happened is now, gay marriage is legal in several states, and attitudes have changed a lot. And a lot of this is basic systems theory, that if any part of a system changes, the system has to adjust. And one way it adjusts is to kill somebody or get rid of them or say, you're exiled from the family, we don't want to know you ever again. But that changes them too. But the more typical way is nothing seems to change for a while, but they've had a new experience. So the fact that things don't change quickly doesn't mean they're not changing. That's other thoughts on that one? Yes, back there.
That was the older model of leadership, and that's what, as a collective, we had. But that in our modern world of information overload, and everyone has a voice, everyone's saying things so loudly that how do you get your voice heard, that doesn't work anymore. And that's what we're transforming leadership into, is being who you are, and doing that inner work, becoming the authentic person that you are, and in doing that, others just, they pick up on that. They see that. They feel that authentic energy. And that in itself gives you a voice of authority. And I think I'm seeing that shift in the collective of, that's what's needed more and more, is more of us to do that inner work, become who we are. Just, if you're gay, be gay. It's not just about like going out and saying I'm gay and hammering it over people's heads. It's just being who you are, and I'm seeing that more and more, that that's what's transforming, you know, collective ideas. So I don't know.
Yes. Well, I was curious as to the people who met at the Fetzer Institute. They're all leaders of companies or organizations?
Some of them social movements.
What was their, collectively, what was their main concern? What did they bring out as, this is what I'm dealing with, or this is what I'm...
Of course, the subject was what's working in terms of leadership. But if I were to say, it really was about very often they saw things that needed to happen that looked like they couldn't happen. And that could be the Ford Motor Company needing to have hybrid cars, which they now have, but at some point it didn't look like it was going to happen. Those kinds of things. There were some people who were working, as we were just hearing about, in, well, it was one person from Rwanda who was talking about, what do you do when you have a whole traumatized country and you're trying to pull people together when you had genocide? So there were big issues like that, but a lot of them came down to how do you help people change their consciousness to do something that needs to be done. Yeah. Yes?
You said in your talk that the organizations like Pacifica, for example, they give expression to various archetypes and not others, or more than others, and that, we do as individuals. So I'm curious about your more about that whole subject, but particularly right now there are a lot of demonstrations to try to talk about Ferguson and to change the way police act towards the population. So what archetypes are these? Are the people in the streets? What's operating there in the demonstrators? Do you have any thoughts on that? Where they're coming from as far as the archetypes that are being expressed in their decision to go into the streets and to march together and to carry signs and so forth.
Yeah. Well, I'd like to hear other people's views too. There's two that come to mind. One is revolutionary. You know, there are times that we stand up and say enough. And remember that the demonstrations aren't just about Ferguson. They're about a whole pattern of things that go on in this country that after the civil rights movement, there was a hope that they had gone, and they're not entirely gone. And it's a lot of the various discriminatory things that are actually happening. But I also think the process that I was talking about is really a magician process. It's often collective, and it's often just standing up and saying enough. And the difference between, I can't tell yet, but the difference between the revolutionary process and the magician process is the revolutionary process always has something they want to tear down. And an enemy to be overcome, or the evil leaders are. And the magician process is not like that. And I think back to Martin Luther King, who was so brilliant about being in a magician archetype when he would call people in the United States to our fundamental values. And rather than saying, he talked about the pain that segregation created and discrimination created, but then he went on to talk about our values of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And also, as a Christian minister, he talked about Christian values. We're all God's children. And in that sense, if the demonstrators can connect with those larger values to pull people with them, it'll be magician, otherwise it's revolutionary. And although this country was actually founded by revolutionaries... the country doesn't treat them very well in real, you know, when in modern times. So wait and see. Anybody else have a yes?
I don't know whether my comment applies You mentioned the context of people. There's no good God, there's no bad God. And my experience in the whole society is traumatized. And so I have become very careful distinguishing between perpetrator and victim, because both are traumatized. Mm-hmm. And so that is where the third story is from.
That's a third story.
We may need some paradigm like that to deal with the question that was raised.
Yeah. Thank you.
Last thoughts? Yes.
I have a quick comment and a question. The comment is for the lovely lady in the front. When she asked, what is the part that I have to carry? I don't know it, I don't want to sound patronizing, but how I approach things in my family, it's with an open heart. Just open heart, over brain, over everything. And this is when things start transforming for me. And the question is, I again apologize, I'm not a union scholar, I don't know what a shadow self is, I just can have some idea, but can you just give me a quick...
Yeah, the shadow self is what we've repressed, and then the shadow self is what we've repressed and don't want to look at about ourselves, but then it can actually be wonderful things about ourselves or not so pretty things that we don't want to admit about ourselves. But it's that, and that both of those tend to be projected. That is, the better part of ourselves we don't see. We project onto the people we admire, and the ugly part of us that we don't want to see, we project onto other people who may act in that kind of way. And sometimes we don't actually act on it. Let's say if I want to murder somebody, I have murderous feelings. It doesn't mean I murder them, but it means I may not want to look at the fact that I had that feeling and that therefore I could identify and I could either use that feeling to have empathy for why somebody could do something like that who didn't have as much impulse control as I did, or I could project that how bad they are so I don't have to look at myself. So that's what it means. I'm going to... I'll check to see if there's anybody else dying to say something. Otherwise, I want to tell you, I'd love to see you tomorrow morning because we are going to have so much fun. And I'm going to learn so much, and so are you, and it's just going to be great. So I hope you go home and have a nice rest and show up. So blessed be.
And that is the end of the recording. This recording was made on DVD, and it included some images. The DVD is available in the library at the C.G. Jung Society, Seattle. The copyright is C.G. Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.